Birth, The Grand Division, Chapter 8. "I really don't need any advice on this, thanks," said Riker with the slightest of energy to his voice. "Mr. President, Chief of Staff is the pivot man for your whole presidency. There are only 2 million minutes to a presidential term, not counting sleep. There are at least that many people who want one of those minutes." "You need me," said Margaret. She had been right outside the Oval Office door for years and was the closest thing to a chief of staff the last president had. The previous 43 presidents had one or perhaps two in their entire time in office. The last president had 6 in 7 years. Of course, he spent nearly a year on the golf course in total. The men who held the job of gatekeeper resigned one after the other because it was ruining their careers. "I want you to invite Miss McKenna to the White House as soon as possible, this week, hopefully," said Riker, as he placed the letter of invitation signed by him on Margaret's desk. "Yes, sir," she said flatly. "I'll be in my back office for an hour. Hadid," motioned Riker to his trusted agent, who leaned away from the wall and began walking behind the president down the hall toward the president's quarters. Riker made a small motion with his fingers on his left hand that Hadid had learned to recognize as a request to move up beside him. As he matched the president's step on his left, the president whispered to him, "I need a sounding board. Can we go down into the vault and talk?" he asked. "Yes, sir." The two men passed a dozen paintings of other presidents hanging on the walls of this famous hallway. The test of history was captured in the faces of these men, who held the freedom of the whole world in their trembling hands as they prayed for guidance. It was Riker's turn. This time the world was really coming apart. The leadership of saving as many souls as possible had fallen to him. Like any president faced with war just over the door sill of their first term in office, he felt beneath the task. The big picture was almost overwhelming enough. But when he thought about the millions of faces of people who were trapped in their lives with no hope of escape, his heart wanted to break. He wanted to talk to past presidents and ask them what they did with their heart while they made decisions that would affect so many. He always felt passionate about tearing the National Defense Authorization Act apart, simply because it tossed due process into the muddied tracks left by a mech unit. He used to fume at the power of the IRS and how that agency had openly and illegally targeted the enemies of past administrations like an economic hit squad. He knew in his gut that the framers of the Constitution were inspired by God, and that the reason the Second Amendment was made the Second Amendment was to keep the government from taking the other rights away. The union of the polarity meant there would not likely be a second term to this presidency, not in the world that it is now. He thought about what a president might do in the new, higher vibrational world. Then he wrestled with the presumption that he would go with it. What if he didn't make it? What if, like Moses of old, he would not be permitted to go to the land of milk and honey? He needed to talk to someone. He needed the perspective of one of the oldest orders of protection the world had ever known. Hadid took out his magnetic card and held it against the corner of the wainscot panel at the end of the hall past the entry door to the president's quarters. There was a quiet thud as the wall panel released, admitting the two men behind it. He pushed it closed, and they walked down the descending hallway to the elevator door. Again, the card opened the sliding steel door, and the two men stepped silently inside. The vault below the White House was designed at great expense and secrecy. It was shielded against EMP and against microwave sensing technology. They even consulted Long Beach State University to figure out if there was a way to shield it against remote viewers. The consensus was to carry no gifts of any kind into the vault. They learned that gifts could be linked to a remote viewer, and anyone in the presence of that gift would be under surveillance by that remote viewer. It was even tested at a depth of 1,000 feet in a nuclear submarine, and the remote viewer could see what was going on in the proximity of that gift. During the test, the gift was a crystal ashtray. To this day, that ashtray sits in a wooden box in a dark and distant government warehouse. A copy of it sits in a display case of presidential gifts. The elevator arrived and the doors opened to a plush sitting area. Down the hall was a small kitchen where he had first met the two tall white Secret Service agents, Enoch and John. Their strength was elegant and terrible. Their message was connected to the dawn of time, it seemed. Riker sat in the red leather chair while Hadid walked down the hallway to make some tea. For the last few nights, he had been awakened by a dream. While Hadid prepared the tea, he reflected on the dream. When he came to his senses in the dream, he was sitting in a drop cave. The hole was in the top of the cave, and the cavern was about 20 feet across. The sun was still up, and light poured in through the opening, which appeared to be hidden by bushes growing around it. He could hear horses stomping and men shouting to one another in a strange and harsh language. He looked across the cave and noticed two other men sitting on the floor. One man was dark-skinned and huddled under a brown blanket with only his frightened eyes looking at him. He held his knees close to him with rough hands that had seen many years, making a life out of the dust of the earth. The other man was lighter-skinned and smaller in size, barely the size of a boy. He spoke to him. "Don't let them catch you alive. If they catch you, kill yourself," he said quietly. The huddled man shifted his eyes to the other and back to him. Fear exploded his pupils to the edge of the whites of his dark eyes. That instant, the dream shifted to another place. He was standing in the fog on a dry, muddy surface. The fog was hanging just above what appeared to be a dry lake bottom. He noticed footprints everywhere, in every direction. He didn't know which way to go, but he knew he had to begin walking. Hour after hour, he walked through the cool and silent fog. Slowly, the fog lifted to a point just over his head. He could see for a distance across the dark and cracked lake bottom. Then, as though just noticing for the first time, a small gathering of houses came into view. They were all white at one time, but were left peeling and gray in the fog. Each house was built up on stilts about 4 feet off the lake bottom. There were two rows of houses about 150 feet apart, each unit about 50 feet from the other. He paused for a while. He was afraid of being seen. He froze as he suddenly saw a man come out of one house on the left. He looked both ways, walked down the black wooden stairs quietly to the ground, and then ran across the muddy street to a house on the other side. He did not look up from the ground. He, too, moved like a rabbit, hoping to avoid the fox. Riker took a few steps forward in his dream, only to be stopped again. Far down the lane between the houses was a tall figure. He was lean and walked with long and graceful steps like a fighter. As he neared the second house and then the third, Riker could see a bow slung over his shoulder and a long sword hanging to his knee-high boots. The man could see him, surely, but as he approached, a most remarkable thing occurred. One of the house doors opened. A man ran down the stairs and out to meet the approaching figure. As he arrived, the figure stopped in his tracks. The running man embraced the figure, who was at least a foot taller than the runner. Another door opened, and then another, and within seconds there was a crowd of perhaps 50 people surrounding this man, who did not move. Riker could hear them, trying to carefully not make too much noise, but also trying to speak above one another. "How are the others?" one would ask. "When will this be over?" from another. Then, as though through some sort of magic or sleight of hand, the figure looked directly at Riker. He ducked down into the crowd of people and bounded out the side and in what seemed like 5 steps. Went up the stairs of one of the houses and into the door. No one in the crowd saw him do this. They were all still pressing into the center, trying to touch him and be close to him. Riker saw the house he entered. Slowly, as though not to disturb the fog itself, he moved to the side of the lane. He walked sideways through the cool, moist air, barely breathing, to reach the base of the steps leading into the house with the man inside. He stepped up onto the first step and reached for the black-framed, rusty screen door and opened it. Within seconds, he was inside, and he followed the screen door closed with his left hand so that it made no sound upon closing. There on the hardwood floor of this otherwise barren room was an almost pyramid-shaped stack of old car batteries. There were small red and black wires going from one battery to the next, and Riker could see they were hooked together. He walked around the batteries to the other side, and the wall was blank and without furniture of any kind. He noticed 3 men sitting cross-legged on the wooden floor with their backs against that wall, so he sat down beside the closest one. No one spoke. He looked back to the screen door, and to the rear of the stack of batteries was an old metal Royal typewriter table with the wings extended. On top of the table was a gray metal film projector, and he became aware that the projector was attached to the stack of car batteries. Also to his left was an arched doorway that led to another room in the house. As dreams will unfold, but without any foreknowledge, the tall figure of a man walked under the archway and up to the rear of the projector. Riker could see his face now. His hair was closely cut and dark. His eyes were steel blue, and his mouth was thin above a strong chin. He stood perhaps 7 feet tall, with broad shoulders and no room for fat anywhere on him. His sword and bow were gone, and his hands were long and powerful at the end of lean and rippled forearms. He reached forward to the projector and placed his hand on the switch. "Behold," he said in a deep and protective voice. And when the light splashed onto the wall to his right, the light was so bright that Riker slammed his eyes shut. In that instant, the dream ended, and he found himself alone and trembling in the most powerful home in the world. Hadid quietly walked into the room with a tray carrying the 2 teacups with saucers, a white porcelain pot, and a white linen. The last time he was here in this place, there were 2 more agents, and John had poured the tea. He was enchanted with the precision process. It was an art crafted over thousands of years. Hadid placed the tray onto the table in front of the leather chair. Without a rattle, the teacups were placed onto the table with their saucers, each handle facing to the right at exactly 90-degree angle. With his right thumb and index finger, he gripped the rear handle of the white porcelain pot and placed the first 2 fingers of his left hand onto the lid of the pot. He perfectly lifted the pot and poured the president's cup to within 1/2 inch of the lip. He rocked the pot back and gently moved the pot to do the same to the 2nd cup, precisely and with purpose. And then he set the pot back down on the tray and put his hands to his side. "Mr. President," he asked as he settled into the leather chair opposite him and reached for his cup. "Yes. Thanks for doing this, Hadid. I needed someone to talk to. You're more than a guardian, you know." "I try to be, Mr. President." "Lorraine McKenna is an esoteric manager. Besides being a world-renowned public speaker on subjects like multidimensional chakras and earth changes, she has a PhD in business transition management. She is an expert in every way, but she has 2 things no other chief of staff has ever had." "What would that be, Mr. President?" asked Hadid. "She has the ability to understand what is going on with the union of the polarity and 2X chromosomes. "The fact that you think that latter is a qualification is fine with me," said Hadid. That's not what I was looking for, said Riker. Everything is prophesied, right? I mean, there is a certain way things have to be done, correct? Not everything, Mr. President. Prophecies are conditional predictions unless they are instructions, said Hadid. Oh, crap. What's that supposed to mean? He said, frustrated and still reeling from the reflection on his dream. Well, this is what will happen if you keep doing that, he said. It's more like a view of the future, but it's still a choice. A choice? You mean the two planets won't come apart if we don't want them to? Asked Riker. Well, to everything there is a season, and this is the season when the Earth transitions. That cannot be changed, because we already agreed to that. Who agreed? I didn't agree, shot Riker. Yes, Mr. President, you did. Long before we came here, you agreed, said Hadid, putting down his teacup. Worlds are made for us. We are stewards of them. It takes immeasurable energy and planning to put one of these together just right, where it will support so much life. And then that life must be chosen and placed here to reach a balance of its own. Then we are placed here to use it as we see fit. We agreed to be part of it, and when to be part of it. All consequences aside, as that is purely a personal path, the whole creation is either heaven or hell as we make it. We are here to try to keep souls from being harvested away into darkness that did not come from darkness. And maybe we can harvest some souls from darkness along the way, explained Hadid. The planet is about to come apart. We're not talking about two terms and then another round of party fights. I may not even complete one term. I need this woman to help me not make any mistakes. We don't have time for mistakes, said Riker. He took a couple of sips from his teacup. The black tea was strong and had a powerful aftertaste that showed it was the highest quality leaves, picked and dried just right. He detected a slight tinge of nutmeg. And then there are those stupid dreams, he said. Dreams? You've been having dreams? Asked Hadid. Yes. Why? Tell me, Mr. President. Are they lucid? Asked Hadid. Lucid? What does that mean? Do they seem real? Are they in sequence? Do they have smells, color, emotion? Asked Hadid. Hell yes, they do, said Riker with a slight choke to his voice. He took another sip to calm his throat and looked unblinking at Hadid. And in the last days, God says, I shall pour out some of my spirit upon every sort of flesh, and your sons and your daughters will prophesy, and your young men will see visions, and your old men will dream dreams, quoted Hadid from the second chapter of Joel. You think these come from God? Asked Riker. They are horrible. They're like visions of the apocalypse from the ground floor. They are information, Mr. President. Universes share information in the form of energy, said Hadid. We are immersed in it. Some hear nothing. Others hear according to their aptitude. Some use that knowledge for dark designs. Others choose pathways of enlightenment, said Hadid. The experience is real enough. Well, that's for damn sure, said Riker. What about McKenna? Asked Riker. Bring her in. We shall see what we shall see, said Hadid. I am. We're calling her tomorrow. Is that all, Mr. President? Yeah, I suppose so. Strange way to get some tea, posed Riker. Tea needs no excuse, Mr. President. Any time, said Hadid as he placed the saucers back onto the tray and carried it back into the small kitchen. One day at a time, Bob. One day at a time, he said quietly to himself.